we followed each other for a while and discovered we were both single. Mm-hmm. And that turned me off and that turned him on, right? Because I was like, no way, no men, no men. I hate men. I'm all done with them. They're all the same, you know. And I just didn't want to mess up my equilibrium because I finally was writing regularly. And for him, it was kind of the opposite reaction. It was an eligible woman who was within reach, who he had a lot in common with. Sure. And he became a fan. And then he did something that really hit me. He posted a picture of himself holding up my book.
The Way to an Author's Heart.
A positive review of it. And I was like, wait, I didn't write that book for men.
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Well, hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. We have a delightful interview today, which we just finished. Judy, tell folks the title of this podcast.
Couples Therapy with a Dead Man, an interview with Billy Best.
Yes, and you know, it was just when we looked at this, I just looked at that title and I realized, you know, if you look at this and think Billy Best is a man, you might be thinking we are interviewing a dead man named Billy Best, which we are not at all. Billy Best is a woman. She was married to a man who died, and she's just fascinating. We had a lot of fun with this interview, and we hope you will have a lot of fun listening to it as well. Let's put in a word for, first of all, this podcast. Please promote the podcast and go to our website, which is ctin7, that's the number 7.com. And that's where you can write to us. That's where you can find our merch. We have wonderful mugs and t-shirts and tote bags. And that's also where you can find all of our past episodes as well. So we hope you will do that. Mm-hmm. And let's put in a word for the book.
Right. It's Not About Communication. Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong
Available.
Is Bruce's latest book.
Anywhere books are sold, you can get
and
that.
And in different formats, paperback, audiobook, and ebook.
Indeed. And the audiobook, I did the narration myself, mm-hmm. and it's proven to be one of the more popular choices. And the book that got this whole podcast started back 3 years ago.
Right. Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
Also available anywhere books are sold. Also available in all of those three formats. Mm-hmm. So without further ado, let's go to our interview. You will hear Judy introducing our guest, and then you will hear what I just hope you will find, as we did, a delightful interview with Billy Best. And we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Billy Best. Billy Best is a writer with a weekly blog at billybest.com and 2 books published in 2020. Her memoir, How I Made a Huge Mess of My Life, or Couples Therapy with a Dead Man, combines poignant insight and delightful humor to describe her passage from her 40s to her 60s. Her collection of essays and short stories, I Could Be Wrong, 50-plus blog posts, short reads, big laughs, wit, and wisdom, relays bursts of gut-punching truth in a fresh perspective on life beyond 60. Currently, she resides in Oregon with her boyfriend and her dog. Billy, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm very glad to be here with you. I enjoy your work.
Well, thank you very much. And I've been reading your blog posts. And as I mentioned, Bruce and I recently read your book, which was just fabulous.
And I was mentioning, before we started this recording, how I like memoirs, but I am not, you know, often just grabbed by one, and picked up yours and started reading, and I just kept on reading and stayed. You cost me part of a night's sleep, I have to say. But it was fun because it was really, I just enjoyed the read greatly. So we had a lot of fun.
It was like, I'm laughing out loud in some parts. I'm crying in other parts. I mean, it was, and it's just, you're such a wonderful writer. So it was just delightful to read. So thank you for sharing that with us. And it was very brave, a lot of the things that you shared. You're very honest. Well, I guess you have to be if you're doing memoir, but boy, you did not hold back.
You know, I learned from my writing coach that that's what readers wanted from me. Mm-hmm. And it was very challenging. And it took me a long time to write that book because I was not comfortable with it.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
And writing the book ended up being a very therapeutic exercise.
That's, you know, actually, let me start off by asking you about the subtitle, which of course grabbed us because here you were doing a podcast called Couples Therapy in 7 Words, and your subtitle of your memoir is Couples Therapy with the Dead Man, which I just thought, of course, having read the book, I can understand it. But could you, you know, explain to folks, like, what's that about?
Well, my marriage was failing at the same time that my husband was dying of cancer.
Hmm.
And so a lot of marital issues that weren't related to cancer got set aside and weren't discussed and weren't resolved. And then after he died, I discovered he'd been having an affair for at least a few years, maybe mm-hmm. longer.
Mm-hmm.
That really blindsided me. And it wasn't until I wrote the book and finished the book. So timeline, he got sick in 2008. He died in 2009. I kept a journal the whole time, but I didn't start writing the book until 2016. And I didn't finish the book and publish it until 2020.
Mm.
So from 2009 to 2020 is how long it took me to go through the process of reconciling what I went through.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a very long time. And as you know from reading the book, a lot of my thinking was misguided. And I so wished I could have talked to him about so many of my thoughts about, you know, reflecting on our marriage. Mm-hmm. And I sure did wish we'd been in couples therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like couples therapy with a dead man. It was one-sided, and you know, that doesn't, well, since the marriage is over, it wasn't going to work anyway, but I did have the feeling of it being a one-way conversation, and I really tried to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but you know, when you learn about that, especially when your partner's not there, where do you put all that anger? You know, what do you do with all that anger that you have? That, what do you do with it? You
know? Well, I'm still dealing with it, frankly. And, you know, I have a new partner now, and our relationship mm-hmm. is only 2.5 years old. And I can see myself evolving as I learn to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
I learn to trust.
Mm-hmm.
I witness my own resilience. And see that even if something goes wrong here, I'm going to survive.
Yeah.
And nothing in my future can be worse than the stuff that's already happened to me. And that sounds really bleak, but it also gives me confidence.
That, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You know, that's something that I so often hear from folks that I work with, you know, as a couples therapist, and often say to folks as well, you know, I've never had anybody in the office sit there and say, hey, thanks for cheating. You know, never heard that one. I have definitely heard people say, in effect, thanks for precipitating a crisis, because it was pretty clear we were headed for one. And and in fact, I had one, I always like to quote this. I quoted this person in my last book, actually. She said, thanks for taking one for the team, to her husband at the end of our work. And he said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, you know, in effect, yeah, something had to happen. And you're the one who had to feel guilty. Because you're the one who did the cheating. So, you know, she wasn't like saying thanks for cheating, but she was saying, well, you know, she was so much better off for having gone through that crisis, and they were much better off with each other, it turned out. And of course, as you know, not all couples stay together, but this couple not only stayed together, but, you know, as is typical of couples that stayed together, their relationship was better for having gone through the crisis. And that's how they were able to stay together. If it isn't going to be better, they probably won't stay together, because that's what led them to, you know, to have the crisis.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's interesting you describe that sense of resilience, because so many people going through a crisis like that, when they get to the other side, will be grateful for it.
Well, in a strange way, I'm grateful for everything I've been through, because I really believe I'm in a very good place right now. I'm in a solid relationship. I laugh inadvertently, you know, after going for a few years without laughing, like it was just, you know, it, you really feel, I feel the joy. And also this feels solid. It's 2.5 years old. We're both in our late 60s. And so I have to have gratitude for what I went through because I really believe there was only one path to this moment, and it's the path I took. And everything I learned, I'm using now, and it's making my life better.
Yeah, that's when I've talked, you know, our seven words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And what you just said, it would be more or less how I define faith. It's that recognition that reality is right to be what it is, even when it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
It's right to be what it is. There's some, you know, we may not always understand all the ins and outs, but there's some valid basis for what reality is. And that's what I mean by faith and orientation to the world.
And I see so much of that quality in your writing. I mean, just the fact how much trauma that you went through with your husband dying and then your mom dying, what, 9 days later.
Yes.
And just the loss that you have experienced, you know, loss of family members, loss of your lifestyle, and you switched it around. I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but you seem to have turned things around and come out on the other side, and you still seem to be rather optimistic and have a good outlook. I mean, we first came across your article in Art Magazine. That's when I noticed it was an article on aging and sex. And
I have to, because we do have the occasional listener who's under 50, I think. And so I have to translate ARP for those young folks who haven't been captured by the AARP. It's the AARP, American Association of Retired. Well, I don't think they call it that anymore. They changed.
They call it ARP, but
it's not just retired.
Yeah, it's not just retired people. But in any case, yes, that's where we saw you.
Okay. Yeah. The issue. So it talks about Billy and Roger. So you want to tell us how that relationship came about?
Well, I was completely committed to being single, and I really wanted to be a writer. And then in 2016, I was selling the farm. That was my last really big loss, and gathering up everything to leave. Of course, I had a lot of scraps of writing and I needed something to do. And so I started writing the memoir in 2016 after I sold the farm.
As I recall, and you just finished it today, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of your memoir, you were pretty much saying you were happy being a single person. You know, you were not expecting to be in a sort of lifetime relationship again. And I'm curious, you know, so how'd you end up with Roger?
I was in the apartment in Portland, Oregon, and I was literally following Virginia Woolf's advice that if a woman wants to be a writer, she needs her own money and her own room. So I set up a studio apartment to just be a writing studio. And then the pandemic hit and I was just starting to make new friends in Portland, and all that stopped. I was alone in my apartment 24/7 on Facebook. And Facebook, of course, recommends you to become a friend of your friends. And Roger and I grew up in Illinois in the late 1960s. We had the same music teacher, but at two different schools. She formed a regional choir called Illinois Youth Chorale that was her most talented students from all the places she taught. And Roger and I both ended up in that choir. I was in the choir for 4 years. He was only in it for, I think, a little more than a year because he had to choose between football and the choir, and he chose football. And that's how we knew each other. But it was enough time that I knew what he looked like. We're both in the group photo on the cover of the Holiday album. And I knew the town he lived in, and his school was in my school's athletic conference. And we had many friends in common. So Facebook connected us. And then we discovered that we only lived 100 miles apart.
Oh, so wow.
We followed each other for a while and discovered we were both single. Mm-hmm. And that turned me off and that turned him on, right? Because I was like, no way, no men. I hate men. I'm all done with them. They're all the same, you know. And I just didn't want to mess up my equilibrium because I finally was writing regularly. And for him, it was kind of the opposite reaction. It was an eligible woman who was within reach, who he had a lot in common with. Sure. And he became a fan. And then he did something that really hit me. He posted a picture of himself holding up my book.
The Way to an Author's Heart.
A positive review of it. And I was like, wait, I didn't write that book for men. And then he just started leaving comments on my writing online. And of course, that got my attention because our relationship started with my ego at the center.
Absolutely. Wow. Way to a woman's heart is through her ego.
There that's you. Right.
Well, I suspect that's true of us as men as well. I noted something in one of your recent blog posts that I just super enjoyed because it meshes with something that I've written about too. You wrote, "It's taken me 69 years to learn that I know nothing." I just love that. But I'm curious, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think I also wrote in that post that one of the characteristics of youth is people thinking they know everything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also one of the characteristics of old age.
It certainly can be, yeah.
Yes, people 60s, 70s, 80s, my dad's in his 90s, there's this unreasonable confidence that you've got it figured out because you've done it all. Mm-hmm. And I have learned so many times that I'm wrong, mm-hmm. incorrect, I have to acknowledge that and really try to change my own behavior and be more open to other perspectives, be a better listener, and encourage other people to share their point of view, even if it's not my point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The subtitle of my most recent book, the whole title of the book is "It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong." And, you know, as I've so often pointed out here, spoiler alert, in the last chapter, I point out, it's not just you, everything I know about couples therapy is wrong too. Which is to say that, and of course, the point of it is exactly what you're talking about. It's not that people, of course, we all know what we know, but it's if we think we know and are closing our minds, it's when ideas turn into ideologies.
Yes.
And then everything, it becomes a caricature or whatever the ideas were.
Yes. I just say, I read your, when ideas become ideologies, I read that's your phrase that stuck with me because mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, but it kind of does become that. When you go your whole life with ideas in your head that are unchallenged, mm-hmm. they do take on the strength of ideology, and it can become really hard to shake people out of what they think they know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to be more mentally flexible, mm-hmm. and be more questioning. Like, do I really know that? Is that really true? Mm. It's funny, but you know, my husband had cancer and he was going to die. And I fought that, but that was just how it was. I often wonder if we would have worked our way through that situation had he not been terminal. And I want to believe that we would have, but that's something I want to believe.
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah, actually, I was, you know, wondering about that. You know, what gave you the will to soldier on during those 2 years? You mentioned you had like 2 years of an estrangement.
Yeah.
In your marriage, where, you know, you didn't sound like you two were sharing much, talking to each other, facing the actual problems that were in your marriage.
Yeah, you're right. And I think this is where couples therapy could have been helpful. I had found something in my life that was as important to me as music was to him. And that was farming. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely passionate and obsessed, and I was pouring all of my resources into it and all of my time. And he did not share that passion. He was frustrated with me for not just, I stopped making money, and I was making a very good money in the corporate world. So I stopped the income, but I started spending, and I started cashing in retirement accounts to pay for my farming habit.
Yeah.
And which he saw as kind of like casino, right? Like gambling. And I saw it as similar to all the years that I bought him guitars and sound equipment and microphones. We never resolved that tension.
That's a great, you know, that's interesting, because arguably both of those points of view are true. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you could make a very good case that says, how come I bought you all these, you know, things for your passion, and you're, you know, begrudging my buying things for my passion. And also, oh my God, you know, you're cashing in retirement money for the farm, and that's really gambling, you know? And then you can make a case for both of those, as is so often the case. Do you know what I mean? It's rare that I encounter a couple. Hardly ever do I encounter a couple. This is going to be a double negative sentence. Let me say it in the positive. What I point out to couples almost always in the first session is, well, obviously neither one of you is crazy. Do you know what I mean? You're not nuts. I mean, if only you were nuts, I suppose we could, you know, I could refer you to somebody who could fix your being nuts, but you're not nuts. So that's why this is so, it's hard. You're not crazy. You're not stupid. The problem is it's difficult. It's actually difficult. Yeah.
Well, so the other issue is in tandem to that, but certainly related, he was very depressed and he had some good reasons to be depressed. He was an exceptionally talented musician, and we had moved to a rural community where none of the musicians he had access to were of his own caliber. So he lost that. He was a performer. He lost the stage, right? He didn't have that ego validation. And he got his first really straight job working for the local college as the events manager. So he's facilitating events for all the musicians who come and perform on the stage in the performance center. And he started to just have that midlife crisis feeling of, is this all there is? And, oh, I'm old. He was very depressed. I knew he was depressed. He didn't want to talk about it. I didn't push it. But now I see what a cliche moment that is for a spouse to have an extramarital affair, right? Yeah. That's very cliche. And that's like what they make movies out of, right? Yeah. That moment. And, oh, look, I was busy and I was having the opposite experience. I was really loving farming, and I was getting a lot of ego validation. I had a radio show in Albany. I was doing public speaking at farm conferences. I was getting hired to do research and write grants. And I had my own farm. And so opposite tracks, just like that fork in the road where you just reach a point where you're both going in opposite directions, having opposite experiences. So, with perfect hindsight, it's not surprising that he had an affair with a much younger woman who had been a fan of his from the music business days.
Sort of like you and Roger in a sense, right?
Yes.
Except you're not married.
Right, right.
Enter the juicer. I love that nickname.
Yeah, and folks who wonder where that came from, well, first of all, they should read your book, of course.
Yeah.
But it's because, right, she had given your husband an expensive juicer.
Yes.
And it seemed suspicious to you because why is somebody giving someone that expensive a gift when they're just casual friends, you know?
Right, right.
Seemed odd. Yeah.
So right. She became known as the juicer.
The juicer. You know, and again, something I realized years into writing the memoir, I had affairs with married men when I was in my 20s. Mm. I never thought about payback's a bitch, isn't it? You know, I never thought about those other women. I didn't have empathy or compassion for the wives of those men because I felt like their husbands cheating was their problem. Mm-hmm. That's harsh. It's a bit naive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're in your 20s, you don't ever really think about being in your 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Well, I want to go back to the article, actually, because, you know, one of the things that you were interviewed about, the context of the article was about sex. It was about senior people in their 60s and older. And so, wait a minute, you mean that people in their 60s and older actually have sex? Is that what you're implying there?
Right.
I'm sure people are shocked at that notion. Tell us about that.
At least our children are.
At least our children don't want to know about it. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I get why young people don't want to know about it, because they think sex is all about how they look.
Right.
I mean, isn't that the Kardashians, really? Mm-hmm. Isn't that the whole thing with the algorithms on Instagram and how you can filter your face to make yourself look more conforming with the popular aesthetics? And when they talk about girls being depressed, it's so much about how they look, like their weight, their body type, how they look in their clothes.
And whatever it is, is wrong. That's
yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, so I think that because young people haven't yet had the experience of physical aging and that mental mismatch that we all have when we get older, we're still using the same mind we used in our 20s. We're hearing a lot of the same voices. We have a similar mental relationship with ourselves. And so it's funny, but like when I look at Roger, I don't see an old guy.
I don't
think about how old he looks when I look at him. It just doesn't even enter my mind because we're in this world together and we have this natural relationship with each other. And it's like a really nice chemistry. And just like young people don't look at each other and think, oh, she looks so young. Like a 20-year-old guy doesn't look at a 20-year-old girl and start thinking how young she looks. Yeah. We don't look at each other and think how old we look.
Right.
And so the whole wonder of people having sex when they're older, I think, is misplacement of our understanding of what's sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And what's sexy is a persona.
Right.
Absolutely. But yeah.
It's sexy is charisma and
caring about the other person and how they treat you.
Yes. You know? Yes. Affection. Mm-hmm. Just having affection for somebody.
And well, yeah. And we just did the podcast we did last week about, you know, Jack Moran's book, The Erotic Mind, which is I finally got around to reading after like 20 years of intending to. And he talks a lot about it's that combination, because you need the affection part and then you need some degree of mystery and some obstacles, you know. And what I like to quote David Schnarch here. Do you know that name? He was a sexologist, died just a few years ago. Tragically too young, if you ask me. I think he was about the age I am now. It's like early 70s. And which sounds, now sounds to me young. Isn't that interesting? But that was, he would go around and he would, in fact, I just put this in my newsletter. That's a subtle plug for our viewers and listeners to sign up for my newsletter, and they'll see this in the most recent newsletter. He would, when he would give talks, David Schnarch would give talks, and he would say, okay, folks, at what age do you think men and women respectively reach their sexual peak? And of course, he would get these sort of stereotypical answers like, well, men in their, what would you say? What, men like in their
20s,
men in their 20s, women in their 30s or 40s, you know, whatever, you know, some difference. And he would say, nope, both men and women reach their sexual peak in their 60s and 70s. And of course, as you're saying, he's not talking about hormones, right? He's not talking about hormone levels. Right. He's not talking about sexual gymnastics.
Right.
He's talking about maturity, which is what you need to tolerate the anxiety of intense desire, which a lot of people freak out about. And it's funny because you think that would be fun, intense desire, but it's also scary as hell.
Yes.
And so to tolerate that stuff requires the very kind of perspectives you're talking about. You know, you've been through some life, you've been through some hard stuff, you've developed some sense of confidence in your own ability to be resilient. That turns out to be really helpful to be sexy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because you can have confidence in, well, I am who I am, and I hope you like it. And if you don't, that's a bummer, but I like that. And, and I see that coming from you, and it's like a turn on. Yeah.
It's interesting, the difference between affection and orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting, because I don't think I even really understood that until, well, just within the last few years, as I've been trying to write my own experience in a way that's helpful. I am trying to be helpful to other people my own age. And I've only recently really been able to see it. And now that we're talking about kids in their 20s and their sexual experience, you realize, or I'm realizing now, that affection never even comes into it, right? Mm-hmm. It's raw hormone driven gymnastics.
Right.
And as you get older and you learn to like a person as a person, affection comes into it. That's a different kind of caring. And it's so sex toys, right? One of the things I learned about sex toys, but also for a while, I was really into tantric masturbation because I was alone forever, but I wasn't giving up orgasms, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the things that I found that I realized I really missed, I didn't know I missed it until I met Roger. One of the things that I really missed was affection.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So yeah, I was having, you know, Olympic orgasms, but that's not the same thing as affection.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think makes sex better as you get older is you like weave together affection with all the orgasm, you know, manipulation of our bodies, that our bodies were designed for orgasms. I think our brains were probably designed for affection. I don't know, but it just feels to me like it's two different kinds of relationship. It's two different kinds of touch, two different ways of being together. And as you get older and you start to blend affection and orgasm, I think it's more powerful.
Oh, yeah.
You have a great line in your book. I just love this. When you were talking about how you were in all this debt and financial trouble, I wrote this down because this was one of the lines that totally cracked me up. I knew I was in trouble when I used gaffer tape to repair my vibrator.
And there you go.
Yes, indeed. You know, that combination of affection and orgasm, it's an interesting one, because one of the things that shows up in my office that, you know, people present as issues, and I think I saw more of this when I used to do more individual work. Now I'm focusing on couples therapy for the last few years, but I would often get people, and it would more often be men than women, I think, who would be saying they have a really hard time combining them. They can desire a woman sexually as long as they're not in love with her. And if they are in love with her, all of a sudden, you know, they absorb this message. You know, it's like the Madonna whore complex or something like that, where
yes.
You know, women are either one or the other, and it can't, you know, and what one can learn as you get older. And I, you know, the folks who are dealing with that issue, to the extent they can heal from it, what they can learn is that their partner can be someone they both love and esteem and also desire as a sex object, mm-hmm. both.
Yes.
And
yes.
to be able to combine those two. And they are somewhat in tension with each other, because, you know, who wants to be objectified? Except that I do want you to objectify me. You know, I don't want you to only objectify me, but there are moments when, yep, treat me as an object. I'm happy with that. You know? And vice versa. What can I say?
It makes for a healthy relationship.
It makes for a healthy relationship to be able to be okay with that paradox.
Yeah.
And that is a function of maturity.
I believe it is. I believe that affection, in order for it to just even work, it has to be reciprocal,
mm-hmm.
right? And beneficial. And I think if you can't do that with somebody, that's the problem to start with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that again, that brings a lot of folks into my office, a lot of couples in my office, is that that's what they're having problems with.
Yeah.
And of course, then there's the issue sometimes where libido doesn't always have to be reciprocal.
Yes.
And when it isn't, and well, I mean, look, the extreme of that is rape, you know,
yes.
when somebody just uses someone, whether they like it or not. But yeah. also, even aside from that sort of thing, when it isn't the sort of thing that's reciprocal, it can be really painful.
Yes.
Because, you know, they're looking for two different kinds of relationships almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think to your point, bringing affection into a low libido relationship and integrating affection with intentional arousal can help people who don't feel it, right?
Yes.
Who don't feel the libido.
And they talked about that in the ARB article. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not in your little section of it, but in the
in the whole article. Yeah.
In the whole article. Yeah.
One thing I see in hindsight is that while my husband was dying of cancer, so that was, we didn't know he had cancer until June, and he died in January. But for the 6 months before June, he was not well. Mm. And we were trying to figure out what it was. And during the time that he was not well, it actually it inspired affection between both of us.
Mm-hmm.
He was scared.
Yeah.
I was scared. It was this big unknown. What's wrong with you? Why is this happening to you? How are we going to figure this out? All the doctor's appointments. Then the diagnosis, horrifying. And so even though he did not want to have sex with me, and I thought it was because he was depressed, mm-hmm. and maybe it was because he was depressed, but I also know that during that whole time he was having sex with her. So we didn't have the conversation. I can only speculate mm-hmm. about why his libido didn't show up for me.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually, one of the ways that his death ended up being such a powerful and beautiful experience was because as he got closer to death, our affection for each other really increased because I was trying to help him die the way he wanted to. And he was very appreciative, but also he stopped seeing her about 3 months before he died. And during that time, he didn't want to see her. Of course, now I know it's because their relationship was more physical. We talked, you know, about how young people that sexual arousal is based mostly on physical appearance. And his relationship with her was mostly sexual. And I understand these things now. He said some of this to me. And so even though we didn't sort out what had gone wrong in our marriage and we didn't resolve the issue of his infidelity, he did say things like, she's a broken doll. He did confess that she had issues with alcohol. He did let me know that she called up drunk and demanded to see him and threatened suicide. So he was carrying the weight of his relationship with her at the same time that he was approaching his own death. And there was a point at which he didn't have enough emotional reserve to deal with her and her grief that made his death all about her.
And he knew he could rely on you.
So now after he died,
clearly he loved you too. He had genuine affection for you.
He did love me. And after he died, I saw this after he died, right? I didn't know what was going on in the last 3 months. I knew something wasn't right. I knew something was going on with her, you know, but I really didn't have all the pieces of the puzzle. Now I see that it was our affection for each other that filled the gaps when our sexual relationship ended, when he was dying, when he was way beyond libido, right? He was like he was only 54, but he looked like he was in his 80s, right? Because of cancer. And it was all he could do to just breathe through the day. And to have me playing Florence Nightingale was a gift to him. And it made his death a really peaceful and loving experience. And I'm very thankful for that. Because that also remains a gift to me, because had our infidelity, had his infidelity become at the center of our relationship right before he died, the emotional turmoil that goes with all of that, I don't think I could have had the affection. So that thing of couples therapy with a dead man, that was really all the anger that I didn't have toward him, I had after he died. And that kind of wrecked my life for about a decade.
I can imagine. And now you also had the juicer over to your house. And like, you knew that they had a relationship.
Well, that's when I figured it out. Because here was this woman who had sent him the juicer, which just, you know, what did I do? I went right on Amazon and looked it up. I was like, oh my God, that costs $400 on Amazon, right? And that, so right there, you know, then she started sending him supplements. Then she started sending him greeting cards. Then he was carrying on conversations with her at work that she was referencing in cards. So I found out because I said, why is she sending you all these things and calling you at work? don't hide your relationship from me. You know, if your relationship is okay, then just invite her over. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I didn't know what I was doing when I said that. That was opened the door. He invited her for a whole weekend. And during the weekend, the main thing that I saw that really shocked me was that they wanted to make dinner together.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Okay. Yeah, you saw an erotic connection, basically. You didn't see them in bed, but you might as well have.
Right. Because when you are in a kitchen with somebody and you are comfortable with them, that's a level of human intimacy. Mm-hmm. And I watched the two of them in the kitchen and they were like dancing. Mm-hmm. And they were collaborating in a way that obviously they had collaborated before. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you're sitting there like we are right here in the, and you see something like that. And in your head, you're going through the shockwaves of seeing that while it's still going on.
Yeah. Right.
And that's when I knew that their relationship was much more than just a long distance friendship. Mm-hmm. Then they went into town together without me for a day. And then they went for a walk together without me for a few hours. Mm-hmm. And that really made me realize there was something more to their relationship. But it was September. He was nearing his last chemo treatment, and I was still fighting to save his life with everything I could do.
Yeah.
I still wanted him to have the affirmation of love from his friends as he was dying.
Yeah.
And he insisted to me that they were just old friends, good old friends. And they had an affair in 1984. And I knew that. Mm-hmm. And so he kept saying, you know, it's just leftover from that. Mm-hmm. And So I have been accused by people who've read my book of wanting to believe lies because they were more comfortable.
Which, by the way, makes you a human being, I believe. Just saying.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Because some people have really kind of beat me up around the ears about being so willing to believe that it was just an old friendship and to not confront him. And I'm like, okay, maybe.
But he would have lied to you. And because you loved him, you would have believed it.
Or chose to believe it.
Yes.
Precisely for the reasons you're saying. You know, it is interesting, isn't it? It's so easy to judge other people's actions when you're not actually in their shoes.
Yeah. And, yes.
You know, none of that is crazy. You know, I mean, it's very common stuff that people do. It's only after the fact you can look at it and say, oh, I was believing things that I knew to be not
right.
true.
How could I have been so blind? Yeah, you know, that's where all the self-recrimination comes in. But you couldn't have known because you only knew what he told you.
Well, and on some level,
believe him.
We're all doing the best we can, right? You know, and that's kind of what that's about. So folks who are listening and watching this, I just want to go back and highly recommend your book to them. And Billy, tell folks, how can people get a hold of the book and how can they see your blog?
And there's another book that I haven't read yet. So
yes, indeed. We have.
Tell us about that.
This book is my memoir published in 2020, How I Made a Huge Mess of My Life, or Couples Therapy with a Dead Man. This is my first couples therapy session to actually really deal with it. And I'm glad that I waited this long because I have so much more insight. And I think I understand my behavior better now. than obviously than I did when it was going on. So my book is available at bookstores. If you would like to buy it through a bookstore, you can go to bookshops.org or IndieBound, or you can special order it from your bookstore. I don't think you'll find it on the shelf there, but they can order it. Or you can buy it on Amazon. And of course, it's available as an ebook on all the ebook platforms.
And you have another book as well. Yes.
Hello. I do. This is
I haven't read yet. So
but, the other
so
book.
I, but
this
if, I'm
sure a collection is. Of really blog posts, which were short stories and essays. And it predates my relationship with Roger. It's called I Could Be Wrong. And actually, it's kind of funny, but these some of these blog posts were written while I was finishing the memoir. And while I was finishing the memoir, I had some epiphanies about how my own memory of my own marriage was convenient, incomplete. You know, I did some things in my marriage that now I kind of think were not right.
And you had, of course, that record of it that you had been keeping. And that's interesting. You had a chance to go back and rethink that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
and
so I learned.
That and that book also, that's also available pretty much any place.
It's also available on Amazon and by ebook.
And you have a website where people can look at your blog also.
Yes. My name is Billy Best and my website is billybest.com. And the blog is called Aging Beyond 60, Loving Life, Staying Relevant. And it's really a weekly post about my life, but I try to share the truth of it because I think for people our age, we don't have a lot of relatable role models. I don't consider movie stars relatable role models. And they don't, they don't make a lot of movies about us. So I feel like aging, we're all kind of on our own with it. And yet it's been going on for a very long time. Right. And, if people were just more honest about it and there were more ways to share what it's like, I think it would be easier for everybody and there would be less ageism.
Indeed. Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for doing this.
I'm so glad to be here with you guys. I love your podcast and I'm just very excited to finally have a couples therapy session, even if it is with a dead man.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, you guys, take care.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we enjoyed doing it. She is a fascinating, fascinating writer, and she was a great guest. And her book is filled with lovely stories, as I mentioned in the podcast, some of them hilariously funny, some of them really heart-wrenching. And what a wonderful writer.
A wonderful writer and fearless, really. Fearless. I mean, she,
And she, in addition to the prose, she also writes poetry. And her some of her poems in the book are just so beautiful.
Yeah.
In fact, so. One of the quotes that cracked me up that I didn't mention to her on the air was, now I hope I get this right, poetry is the excrement of the mind. I think that was it. I hope I'm getting it right.
Yeah, I think she was quoting someone else and saying that, wasn't she?
No, I don't think so.
Was that hers?
I think that was hers. Because she was saying, like, you know, to get some of those poisons out of her.
Yeah.
You know, she that kind of cracked me up.
So we hope you enjoyed that. And what we hope you will do, of course, is let other people know about this podcast. You can do that by liking and subscribing and rating us and all that kind of stuff. We hope you will do that.
And in addition to going to our website, there's something new that you can get while you're there. You can sign up for Bruce's newsletter.
You can indeed. You will see a box magically appear when you go to our podcast website, CTN7, that's the number 7, CTN7.com. You will see that box appear. And if you click on it, you will be able to sign up for my newsletter. And when you do that, you will get, free of charge, a $2.99 value, mind
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, that's right. If you buy it, it's $2.99.
Buy it is $2.99 from Amazon, but you will get it free of charge. 7 words to jumpstart your love life. Mm-hmm. It is an ebook, or you can get it as a PDF version. I think it's a PDF version that you download. And that's also readable on your e-reader, by the way, or most e-readers. So you get that for free just for signing up for my very, I don't mind saying, my very informative and entertaining newsletter. Mm-hmm. It's fun to write, and I hope you enjoy it. And it, no spam, folks. It's every other week. I've been doing it pretty much every other Friday. I may vary that some. And I do not provide your email to anyone else for any reason. I do not like spam. And so when you sign up for my newsletter, that's all you will get from me is that, and you won't get it. You know, you won't suddenly get ads for whatever the heck you wrote to me about on Facebook, you know, at least not for me. I don't know. God knows how that works. So let's put in a word for what else? Oh, yeah. If you have a letter you
yes,
would
if
like
you
to
would
write
like,
us.
Yes, if you have a listener question that you would like us to address on the air, please go to CTN7 and write to us. Or if you have a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if you would like to be interviewed on our podcast, I'm sure you have something that you would like to say, contact us at ctn7.com. And who knows, you might be on our next podcast.
You might be indeed. And you can even sign up for a time. There's a place there to sign up for a time to be interviewed. And the vast majority of people who have done that, and it's quite a few who have, we've gone on to interview and had great interviews with. Mm-hmm. If you think you'll be a good guest, I'll bet you will. Mm-hmm. You people self-select very well that way. So we hope you will do that as well. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.